This is Live at Politics and Prose, a program from Slate and Politics and Prose Bookstore in Washington, D.C., featuring some of today's best writers and top thinkers.
We've done a lot of talking about the election in the store and on our blog and with customers and others. And right about now, which is to say exactly 3 weeks and 2 days after our very long and exhausting presidential election finally ended, it seems to me a very good time for a chat with Catlin Moran. We are really glad she's here at Politics and Prose, because I think it's fair to say, at least speaking for myself, that a few of us could use doses of irreverence and truth-telling and eye-poking. A few laughs here and there certainly would be helpful to some and maybe all of us at this moment. Catlin's here to talk, and I hope rant, about all sorts of things, most importantly, what's in her new book. It's called, you can see it right here, it's called Moranifesto. It's a collection of some of her favorite columns from the Times. You know which Times, not the Times that lands on many of your doorsteps, but the Times across the pond in London. It covers subjects from cystitis to Syria, and yes, David Bowie and Hillary and rape and feminism and parenting and hangovers and all the rest. She's been a columnist for more than 20 years. I think some of you have probably written her books, but hopefully some of you have read her books. Hopefully her bestseller, How to Be a Woman. How many of you have actually read How to Be a Woman? Okay, woo, way to go. Excellent. Has anybody read her novel from 2014, How to Build a Girl? Okay, that's great. If you really want to feel like a slacker, first of all, you know that the novel's very, very good, which is hard to do. But secondly, did you know this was not her first novel? Her first novel was written 30 years ago, or nearly 30 years ago, when she was 13. So really makes me feel like a slacker. And I don't want to put too much pressure on Catlin this evening, but I am sure I'm not alone in hoping that somehow she is going to be the one who bursts forth and finally helps us deal with this reality show of a moment we're now living in, who maybe can give us some tips for embracing our own impatience and irreverence and, in my case at least, need for primal screaming. For those of you who don't know how she got into the writing business, she found her own inspiration early in the works of Germaine Greer. When she published How to Be a Woman, she referred to it as, quote, an update on Germaine Greer's The Female Eunuch, written from a bar stool. One reviewer in Slate has called her a combination of intellectual rebel and goofball. I'm not so sure about goofball being quite the right word, but I guess you get the idea. Suffice it to say that she is brutally honest, completely herself, and pretty darn hilarious, addressing issues of class and privilege, gender and race and culture, and all the hype and hypocrisy and hyperbole and absurdity of contemporary life. Personally, I would like to thank her for the clearest and most succinct definition of feminist that has ever been put forward. I think it will withstand the test of time. I know we're all very much looking forward to hearing what she has to say tonight. Please join me in welcoming Catlin Moran.
Hello, thank you all for being here. Were you all out in that traffic? That was exciting, wasn't it? That was quite extraordinary. I've been in that traffic 3 times today. That was quite amazing. And it's because of the Christmas tree lighting, is that right? The Christmas tree's going to get lit? Yeah. I found that out in the second traffic jam when I just was like, fuck this, I'm going to use my legs, and started walking. They were like, oh, they're going to light the Christmas tree, like kind of Obama will be lighting the Christmas tree, and there's going to be like some music and stuff. And I was like, oh, this would be amazing. I could go and see this. What a brilliant coincidence. I've got a couple of hours free. I get to go and see Obama do basically the last thing that he's going to do while he's president, and that would be really emotional, and that'd be incredible. And I could take a picture of myself there and send it to my brother, who's just like the biggest Obama fanboy ever, and it'll wind him up, or maybe it'd be a way of an apology to him for the fact that since he was between the ages of 4 and 14, every day I would say to him, and if you are gay and you want to come out to me, that would be great. And he turned out to be straight, so that all turned out to be quite awkward. So I was like, great, and I'll be there, and I'll see Obama, and the sun setting, it'd be beautiful, and I'll cry, and it'd be like some kind of like end this horrible 3 weeks, it'd be really cathartic, this would be amazing, I'll just have this incredible moment, it'd just be amazing. So I'm walking there, and I'm already crying, thinking about how noble I'm going to look while I'm there. I'm just like, I'm going to have my moment, I'm going to have my fucking moment, man. And then a man stopped me and went, sorry, ma'am, you'll have to have a ticket. And I was like, oh, right, okay. So as a consequence, I've had no emotional catharsis whatsoever. This is going to be my emotional catharsis. But on the bright side, my eyeliner is still intact. So That's the good thing about finding out that you're not invited to something. Your eyeliner will stay on. The format of tonight is that in the same way that the only person who could defeat Godzilla is Mothra, you have to send a kind of one superhero up against another one and one kind of monster up against another one. I am interviewing myself. I thought about kind of doing one big speech, but I do tend to hate the sound of my own voice and try and sabotage myself, and I was like, let's make that process formal. I have simply put a series of questions into this cup, and I will pull them out. And I have, and I don't quite know what this says about my own personality, put in lots of questions there to sabotage myself or fuck myself up. So there we go. Actually, I'm going to start with the reading, though, because I think the reading will give you an idea about what the book's about. I can segue both of these things at the same time, because I can see there the first question was going to be, why did you write this book? And I wrote this book because there were two reasons. One, over the last couple of years, I started off at the Times when I was 17. I wrote a book when I was 13, and my family were very poor. I'm the oldest of eight children. We were raised on welfare. My dad's disabled. My parents were hippies. They believed the apocalypse was coming. You know, just your very average story. And around about the age of 13, I became aware that even though my dad thought that he was in some way going to become rich or famous at some point, that wasn't going to happen, and I would have to do something about the fact that we didn't have any shoes, and that I was sleeping on a mattress on the floor in a room full of mice. So I wrote a novel, because that's what Joe does in Little Women when they need money, and you can learn nearly everything you need to know from 19th century literature. The advice is all there. And then I became a journalist when I was 17. I just faxed a column to the Times because we had faxes in those days. Young people probably don't even know what that is. It was like a letter that went through wires, I think. I'm not really sure of the technology. And they gave me a job, and I was generally some kind of humble ruffle minstrel there. That was my kind of job. I was just some kind of lol jazz trumpeteer, just doing laughs and funny things. And then I wrote a book about feminism, even though I have no qualifications to do so, and it sold 1 million copies and seemed to do quite well. So I was like, oh, okay, even though I didn't know much about that, even though I'm not academically trained, that seemed to be okay, and people seemed to like that book. Maybe I could do the same with the other thing I feel really passionately about, politics. So that is this book here. And the other reason was because two of my former colleagues, Boris Johnson, who used to be a columnist at The Telegraph, and Michael Gove, who used to be a columnist at The Times, are now our secretary, is our foreign minister, and one of the architects of Brexit. And it gets to a point in a woman's life where she sees former colleagues who are sort of, you know, getting these huge roles of state and really fucking things up. And you think, well, I think I could probably do just as good a job, really. I mean, I'd feel confident enough to say I could do as bad a job as them if I was talking about politics. So, hence the book. So I'm going to read the introduction. And I wrote this last year, and it became, I mean, although no one could have ever guessed what was going to happen this year, the year that I like to refer to as the fuckpocalypse. Nonetheless, it was very clear to me that things were changing very quickly. There was definitely an atmosphere out there. And it was very clear that basically things were going to change. Things were changing already at that point. So the introduction is thus. I have heard in the last 2 years the word revolution mentioned more times than I did in the preceding 20. In protest groups, at meetings, and overwhelmingly online, I have heard people talking about revolution as if it is the coming thing, a necessary thing. Occupy, Syriza, Podemos, the Arab Spring, the near breakup of the United Kingdom during the referendum. We slip into talk of revolution constantly these days. We presume a change is coming. Personally, I am thrilled with the current fashionableness of the word revolution, because I like the word revolution. It is my third favourite word, after cathedral, shagreen, and Cumberbatch. But I should make it clear, I like the word revolution as it's defined in the second entry in the dictionary, and not the first. The dictionary's first definition of the word revolution is this: rebellion, revolt, mutiny, riot, insurgency, overthrow, anarchy, regime change, and disorder. And personally, I'm not up for that. The kind of people who are up for mutinies and riots and violent change tend to be young men, the kind for whom an afternoon of being kettled by 600 policemen before breaking free and wanging a brick through the window of Dunkin' Donuts feels like a life-affirming alternative to sport. I, on the other hand, am a 41-year-old woman with very inferior running abilities and two children. So I don't like riots. I don't like anarchy. I've read enough history books to be resoundingly unkeen on extreme politics of either the left or the right. Breakdowns in society, anarchy, overthrows of seizures of power and disorder, because they tend to work out really badly for women and children. They tend to work out really badly for everyone. My general rule of thumb, and as I say this, this is so much more true now than it was when I wrote it. My general rule of thumb is that you're always a little bit closer to the conditions that led to the outbreak of the Second World War than you think you are. I know, right? Bye-bye, NATO. Which is why I'm all for political and economic stability, non-tumultuous cultural change, and the bins continuing to be emptied on time. I like order, and I like calm, and I like not Googling how to get slash hide gun cache in case of breakdown of society. That's why the revolution I like is the second dictionary definition. Revolution. Sea change. Metamorphosis. Transformation. Innovation. Regrouping and reorientation. Now, those are the kind of revolutions that I can get behind. Metamorphoses and sea changes. A revolution that sounds like the moment in The Wizard of Oz where it goes from black and white into colour. Or when Cinderella's ball gown appears around her in a blaze of fairy godmother magic. We don't want an upheaval. We just want an upgrade. Even the most entrenched conservative would find it difficult to argue with the idea of a notable upgrade of the way that we currently do things politically and economically. Capitalism has been the defining political movement of my age, but it has not gone through any thoughtful planned improvements in my lifetime. By way of contrast, I've lived through 10 OS upgrades on my Mac. And that's just something I used to buy play suits from on Topshop and piss around on Twitter. Capitalism is surely due an upgrade or two. We need snow leopard capitalism or Yosemite capitalism. Isn't that the fundamental point of capitalism anyway, of competition and markets and choice? It's kind of weird that under market-led capitalism that we can get 300 different kinds of latte, but only one kind of market-led capitalism. So, we need an upgrade. We need a change. This is what people want. This is what the talk is all about. But what will that upgrade be? Where will this upgrade come from? Well, the answer is obvious. It is us. We are the big, obvious resource of our age. And we are the key and unique resource of our age, because in all of history up until now, most of our processing power has gone to waste. Unless someone with a brilliant mind had the good fortune to be born into circumstances of being male, not dying of a terrible disease before the age of 3, and being able to afford an education and a social situation, usually predicated on location and wealth, which enabled him to spread these ideas, all these incredible ideas that we've had through history have died in the minds of their owners. This, then, is always the ultimate argument for the urgency and necessity of equality. Equality isn't some fabulous luxury that we treat ourselves to when we're rich enough or comfortable enough or happy enough. The legislation and infrastructure that we get round to after we secure our economies or wrangle our foreign policy. Equality isn't humanity's cashmere bedstocks. It's not a present we treat ourselves to like champagne. Equality is a fundamental necessity like water. And that is because in the 21st century, humanity's greatest resource is not oil or titanium or gold or water or tech. It's brains. The real reason more unequal countries are so troubled is, to be brusque, because they are more stupid. They disregard their female populations and thereby halving their potential brain power. And so while we keep these billions of tons of brains offline, we put humanity in an illogically difficult position. By believing some people to be naturally superior, and therefore the only ones who should be in charge, we make our species as a whole inferior and weaker, and, to be frank, stupid. So it's little wonder that we have such a small, incestuous slice of the population representing us politically, because politics have become devalued. These days, if your child announced that they wanted to be a politician, most people would react as if they had come down to the breakfast table and said, "Mother, father, I've decided to become a massive pervert." Our default belief is that politicians are venal, shifty, double-dealing liars out to serve the interests of their friends and their business associates. It's hard for an honourable man or woman or asexual to say that they wish to run a government without instantly being suspected of slight evil. And that is, to use a scientific phrase, balls. Because there's no point in having a democracy if we distrust everyone who wants to engage with it officially. If in the very act of trying to gain power, you lose the trust of the people you wish to represent. That by wanting to stand for something, you are presumed to be wanting to stand only for yourself. There, the entire notion of being a public servant, a key tenet of the modern age, and democracy itself, fails. Thank you. And that is basically the position we're in at the moment. You know, good people do not want to step up to the plate. Good people are scared. You know, the brains trust that we need, that you would hope that was out there planning the future, notably is not around, and particularly on the left. I'm going to take a wild guess and suggest that most of you probably aren't Trump fans. I'm hoping most of my stuff is going to be fairly anti-Trumpy, fairly anti-Brexit, by which I mean totally. Totally. Totally anti-Trumpy and totally anti-Brexity. So that's my political thing. So if you've wandered in here by accident, confusing my name with the name, there's a brand of rum called Captain Morgan. I can see why you might have thought it was a talk by a rum distiller. That's not what's going to happen here. You must go. I am a liberal left person. In fact, I will show you what I prepared. I got something ready for this American tour, so hang on a minute. This was the T-shirt that I got ready. I paid 20 of my English pounds, which is worth about one of your American cents now, given to our given our current economic situation. And because I've heard this phrase used a lot recently as a pejorative. I've heard so many people on both sides of the continent, both sides of the Atlantic, talking about this, using these words or a combination of ones very similar and saying that these are bad people now. Just kind of like, we don't like experts, we don't like the elite, we don't like people in the metropolitan people, sneering, smug metropolitans and liberals, okay? I'm going to break down to you why this phrase here, metropolitan liberal elite, was from the age of 5 when I lived in the ghetto and I was incredibly poor, my hashtag life goal was to become a metropolitan liberal elite. That was absolutely what I was gunning for, and I'm very glad that I'm a fully qualified member of the metropolitan liberal elite. So let's go through them one by one. Okay, one, metropolitan. 52% of the world's population lives in a city. They are metropolitan. That's the majority of the world now lives in an urban environment, and that is going to continue to increase. That is where human beings want to live. That is what we do. That's the growth industry in our lifestyles. We live in cities. So first of all, to say that being metropolitan is like bad, that becomes a pejorative. Congratulations, you've just slagged off 52% of the world's population. Cities are one of the greatest inventions we've ever had because they are a crucible. They're an incredible experiment in humanity and progress and potential. When you have millions of people living in a very small confined space who come from different backgrounds with different thoughts and different disciplines who are continually colliding with each other and intersecting with each other and talking with each other and disseminating information, we accelerate progress at such an incredible rate. This is where we make ideas and test them. This is where we invent new things in our cities. It's very hard to invent something incredible in some kind of incredible symbiosis with people who come from different backgrounds from you, but you all meet together and collaborate on something. If you're on a farm in the middle of Idaho, I'm not saying it's completely impossible, but it's more likely to happen in a city. Metropolis is good. Like metropolis is good. Second, liberal. My understanding of people who think that liberals are bad is that they think liberals are okay with people having sex with whoever they want and being in control of their reproductive rights. That's seen as a bad thing now. I've never understood why these are bad things and why people would want to become in any way involved with what people are doing with their vents and ducts and private parts. I mean, that is the definition of not your business. That is... There's a reason why there's special clothing that kind of cages these areas and protects it. They are literally our private areas. I'm glad to say I am a liberal. So long as you're not hurting anybody else, you do absolutely what you want with all of your glands and sacs and eggs and potential. That's absolutely fine. I'm happy to say I'm too busy to care. I think that should be a motto for all of us. Too busy to care what anybody else is doing in a good way. Thirdly, elite. Experts and elite. We hear time and time again now that we mustn't listen to elites, we must not listen to experts. Elite means the best. That's the whole point of elite, is that you're someone who's studied, you're someone who's practiced, you're someone who knows what they're doing. Like, this means the best. This is someone who spent years trying to be the best, the elite. And I'll tell you why you know elite is great, and why when push comes to shove, everybody will admit that elite is good. Even people have used it as a pejorative. If you are in a plane that is crashing, and there are two sets of parachutes, and one is called the ordinary Joe, I just go with my gut instinct, I'm just a good normal guy parachute, and then the one next to it is the elite expert parachute, you will put on the elite expert parachute. That is what you will do. That is why elites are the best. So yes, that is my t-shirt. Thank you very much. So I'm going to ask myself the first question. Let's see what's in the cup. Hope I've been nice to myself. Okay. Catelyn, you are part of Generation X, or maybe Y. You've often fudged your age. This whole thing that's happened with politics appears to have happened on your watch. Are you not responsible? Well, I would say maybe yes, we are. I feel bad about my generation. There seems to be a fairly good spread of ages here, but I do often feel like my generation should apologise to the next generation down, because we had it really good. We lived in a really sweet spot in history where everything just seemed to be fantastic. Just like the Berlin Wall came down, kind of economies were on the mend, kind of just everything seemed to be, it was just like, you know, just everything seemed to be amazing. And particularly in my country, we'd invented the dance drug ecstasy, and we just spent most of our time smiling at each other, and that seemed to be cultural progress. Whereas by way of contrast, people in the generation below me, you're going to have to spend your adult years giving CPR to whales. Like, kind of, you know, we've trashed the earth. You've got a lot of problems to sort out. So I do often think it probably is our fault, and I'm very sorry about that. And I think the job of my generation, I think this narrative of the way that politics is being run at the moment, this story's ended now. We've done this. This is the end. We're going to have to find new stories and new ways of talking about the future. One of the things that's been most notable in politics, both in the UK and here, is we've stopped talking about the future. In the 1960s, it was all about progress. It was about the future, about what a city's going to be like in 20 years' time. How will our lives have changed? What kind of people, what kind of new citizens, what new kind of opportunities will we have? Now, all the talk, both in the UK and America, is going back. It's all about going back to a time when a country was better than it is now, back to when America was great. Let's make Britain great again. We're withdrawing back in. We're not inventing any new kind of future. And I think it is going to be down to the next generation to start imagining brilliant new cities again. And this is one of the reasons why art is so important in culture. We need to start inventing and showing on the screen and in books and on TV possible parallel worlds, possible futures that we can see whether we would prefer them to what we've got now. I would suggest, yes, we would. I would personally at the moment rather live in either Westworld or Game of Thrones than what we've got now. Who's watching Westworld? Ah, it's amazing. I'm really worried about Tandy Newton's breasts. For those who aren't watching it, Tandy Newton's an amazing actress who is playing a robot who appears to be naked in every single scene, I suspect because it's a male director. And Tandy Newton's breasts at the moment should be up for every single award going. There is no acting duo in the world at the moment that are doing more work than Tandy Newton's nipples. They are Golden Globes, Emmys. Well, they are Golden Globes. She deserves every award going. What have we got next? Oh, yeah. Catelyn, can you put your entire fist in your mouth? Yes, I can, yes. So, I'm going to talk to you about the internet, because the next question is the internet evil? And the answer to that is, it shouldn't be, but at the moment, yes. Yes, it is. At the moment, we are living through one of the biggest events. Well, first of all, it's very clear that we're living through an epoch and an era that we have not yet put a name to, because we're right in the middle of it, and we're too busy spending most of our time going, what is going on? One of the things that needs to go on is coming up with a name for this epoch. But one of the defining things of this epoch is that we are going at the moment through one of the biggest things that's ever happened in human history, the biggest migration in human history. And that is not the 60 million refugees that are on the move in various places around the world at the moment, although that has influenced politics in terms of fear and how much we fear change and the impact of these people coming to our countries. It's not that. The biggest migration in human history is the fact that 3.7 billion people now live, to all intents and purposes, on the internet. To a greater or lesser extent, 3.7 billion of us are on the internet. We've migrated our banking there, our love lives, our social lives. You know, this is where we get jobs. This is where we find our flats. This is how we get our transport. We live there. And the most important thing about it is it's where we talk. It's where we decide what conversations consist of these days, what phrases are allowed, how we phrase arguments, how we talk to each other, how we disseminate information. And if you look at the internet, and particularly social media, demographically and in the way that it operates, it basically represents and is wholly mirrored by California during the gold rush. This is an almost entirely male-dominated arena. 92% of coders are male, so all the arenas that you're operating in and discussing things in have been programmed by men. So there's a sort of very male style to the way that things are phrased. Conversations unroll in a male way rather than a female way. The social media is very young. You tend not to see tribal elders on there who would sort of go, hey, calm down, or that's unreasonable, or actually we went through this before in the 1940s, you're a Nazi, shut up. So they're not there. Women, trans people, LGBT community, people of colour, they're not as well represented because there's only so many rape and death threats that you can get on social media before you start to go, oh, I don't really like it here anymore. I might go somewhere else. So it's basically like California during the gold rush. It's very young, it's very male, it's very aggressive, it's very white. And on top of that, we still haven't yet decided or agreed amongst ourselves whether the internet is real or not. The amount of times I've heard someone say, yeah, if you're getting abuse on the internet, it doesn't count. That's not real. Cybercrime is massive. 1 in 10 of us will be affected by cybercrime. If you get, say, your card cloned or your identity cloned and you report that to your bank, the majority of the time they won't even inform the police. It doesn't get reported. It's just absorbed. It's just easier for them to absorb it in their finances. So the internet is a place where that is essentially lawless. You know, you can be abused there. If someone shouted at you in the street, they would be arrested. If you do it on the internet, it's fine. If someone steals money from you on the street, they would be arrested. That would be a crime that would be pursued. It doesn't happen on the internet. So this is this weird, lawless place that we don't even know if it's real or not. We don't know how to treat each other. And that has clearly set the tone for what is happening politically at the moment. There has been a corruption of language. There has been a perversion of the way that human beings sit and talk to each other and exchange information. There's been such a massive and recalibration of the value of information, the value of voices. It's happened so rapidly that it makes my head spin. My children have no idea that politics didn't used to be like this. It's happened so quickly. You get a time hop anniversary on Twitter that celebrates your anniversaries when you went there. It was my 7th anniversary on Twitter a couple of weeks ago. And so it shows you all the tweets that you were sending that week. And they're all to my friends who are also politicians and write about politics. And we're all going, politics is so boring at the moment. No one wants to talk about it. No one wants to engage in it. Well, that changed. You know, but that was 7 years ago. Things have happened so incredibly rapidly. So we need to look at, you know, one of the first things we need to do, because I'm sure we're all at the moment going, what can we do? You know, I've probably got another 3 or 4 weeks of crying in me. I'm planning to cry through Christmas Day. I'll cry through Boxing Day. New Year's, I'm going to stand there watching the ball drop, just going, why? But then when we hit January, we've got to do something about it. What can I do? There's a load of things we can do. The first one is on a practical basis, look where your money is. You know, look where your money is invested. What bank do you use? The simplest thing you can do is just look at a bank, make sure you go and invest in I don't know what the equivalents are here, but like building societies or mutual investment societies and stuff. It's a pain in the ass for a day, but it's better than a Nazi totalitarian state. You know, look at where your money is invested. Make sure your money is where your mouth is. Change your bank account. Make sure you do that. Secondly, make sure that you are not part of the problem. It's very easy when you're on the internet and the emotions are high for you to start arguing back in the same way. And you're like, but I have good on my side. I'm trying to protect people. I'm trying to explain why I'm scared. I'm trying to forward an argument and people are shouting at me. I'm going to start shouting back at them. Anger never works because people won't listen to what you're saying. They will just respond to the tone in your voice. There's a brilliant lyric by the band Divine Comedy that says, fate doesn't hang on a wrong or right choice. Fate just depends on the tone of your voice. And it's so true. As soon as you start communicating in anger, people will communicate in anger back to you. And usually they will come at you harder than you want to come at them. After a bit, if you're the nice guy, you're like, this hurts. I don't want it to, you know, stop. I'm not going to be impolite. And that's when they'll go in for the kill. So be polite, be calm, check where your money is. And also for women, whenever you are in the shower, that's a very good time to wash your pantyhose. That's a massive time-saving thing that will help you have time to fight the revolution later. When you're in the shower and you're waiting for the conditioner to set. You have to leave the conditioner for 3 minutes so it works. Just go in there with your pantyhose and you can just like rub crotch and feet with a bit of shampoo and then pop them over the radiator to dry. And that will give you more time to fight the enemy within. Okay, here we are. Okay. Given that Donald Trump is an anus mouth fascist Satan, is it okay to slut shame Melania? No. It's a very simple answer. No, no. You cannot tolerate anybody who thinks that it is. Just leave her alone. Where are we next? What do you think Barack Obama should do now? Okay. I personally would like to see him take over The Daily Show. I think that would be his new and amazing role. Bless Trevor Noah, love him, but I think Barack Obama would be absolutely incredible. He can do the comedy, we know he can sing, and the interviews would be absolutely incredible. And I just like the idea of having a former president. I mean, let's face it, this is the way politics is going at the moment. You know, like kind of, you know, he could go off and work for some kind of incredible peacekeeping mission somewhere and give inspiring speeches and like work to help people and stuff. But kind of what your country needs right now is just one show where someone who actually knows how this country works is sitting there going, no, they got that wrong this week. It would be... That would make me very, very happy. Plus I don't want him to disappear and go and do something where I can't see his face every week. He's so elegant. Where are we next? all right, cool. I'm glad we're all voting for that. Cool, that's good. What is the future of politics? Okay, so young people, I think kind of, many of us old people probably feel quite ashamed at the moment that we let you down. And also, if you look at the demographics, both in the UK and over here, the people who voted for Trump and the people who voted for Brexit tend to be a lot older. There's a massive generational divide at the moment. I think a lot of that is because in many ways, America and the UK are similar. And I think with our older generations, they're just tired. They're just tired of the responsibility. Like, you know, they've been kind of like the world peacekeeping corps for so long, you know, they've had to be kind of noble, you know, they've had to go around doing stuff, they've had to kind of be reasonable, and now they just want to go, no, I'm quite old, I'm quite selfish, I don't want to do this anymore. They really remind me kind of the sort of querulous tone that I've heard in older voters both over here and in the UK is basically when your grandparents, your parents say, oh, we'll look after the grandkids, and you're like, that would be amazing, thank you, and then after 20 minutes they go, yeah, I don't really want to look after them anymore, sorry, and hand them back to you. That's how I feel they feel about democracy now. They're just kind of like, nah, I don't really want responsibility anymore. I'm just kind of, you know, we want to become smaller. We don't want to have to deal with any new things anymore. The tone seems to be, all these new people keep coming into my country, and there's all these new technologies, and all these new things keep happening all the time, and I just want it to go back how it was. Yeah, I just want to shut up shop. I just want to retire and potter around the garden. That's politically how the older generation seem to be acting. Whereas the younger generation are like, no, this is going to affect me. You're going to die in 20 years' time and leave me with this barrel of shit. I would like to really improve this situation. And what I see happening at the moment is that in both the UK and in the US, the two main political parties were formed in a different century. The Republican and the Democratic Party over here, and in the UK, the Conservative and the Labour Party. They were formed in a different century when everything was different, when women still didn't have the vote, you know, when working class people didn't have the vote, and there was still segregation in this country, when technology was completely different, when the industry was completely different, life expectancy, medicine, education, sorry, pardon me. everything was quantumly different, and with the best will in the world, sorry, artichokes for lunch. And, you know, with the best will in the world, this is the framework, this is embedded in the DNA and logic of these parties, and you can see that they're exhausted. Again, we're still not coming up with ideas for the future. And I just think these parties need to end. You know, this is the end of this. We need to start inventing new political parties. If the vote for Brexit and Trump told us anything, it's that people do want change. People do want things to be different. There is a massive fuck you to the entire system, to the entire framework of the way that we're doing things. And that's only dangerous when you don't give people enough choices for what that change should be. There was only really one change thing on the ticket. And in both cases, it was a bad change. It was a destructive change. It was an angry change. And that was the problem that we had there. So we need new parties. Now, it seems absolutely extraordinary to me that politics is the only discipline that I can think of in the world where we don't peer review stuff, we don't test stuff, we don't collect data and go, that's what we should do next. Politics is still based, you know, especially with this old party system, you inherit your vote from your parents, or you just, you know, you like the guy on TV, or you like one or two things that they're saying, because who here has ever read a political manifesto for any political party before they voted? Yeah, me neither. You know, we vote on one or two things and how the guy looks. That's completely nuts. It's got to be the other way around. A manifesto should be incredible. A good manifesto should make you incredibly excited. You should be running into a bar or a school going, fucking hell, Steve, have you seen this manifesto? It's full of incredible ideas. If half this stuff happens, this is going to be an incredible country. This is amazing. I can't believe these guys have come up with all these solutions to stuff. And of course, that's not what they're like at the moment. So this is what I would do. I would go around the world and I would look at data. Obviously, there are a million different ways. There are a million different variables in the way things work. But we're at a point now where you could basically work out what the best two or three educational systems are, what the best two or three healthcare systems are, where the best two or three economic policies are. You'd be able to start triangulating that shit out. As I say, there are a million variables. But we're not even doing that. That's not even where we started doing. That's what we did in everything else. We would always find what the best thing is and start there. That's not what we do in politics, which seems completely crazy. And particularly for a younger generation who are used to being able to go onto Amazon and read 400 reviews of which is like the best hose to buy or like, you know, which is the best watering can. And you can't do that with a political party. There's no choice there. That's, you know, that's why no one gives a fuck. That's why young people aren't voting. That's why there's this massive political apathy. People want some change, and no one, again, which is completely nuts in a capitalist-led society that's all about change, is providing change. So logically, we will start creating new political parties. I'm sure this will happen. And one of the reasons why I wanted to write the book, why it's called Manifesto, it's about, let's talk about manifestos. The two most important things, if we're going to start creating new political parties, is one, what space will that be happening in? Which is why the internet's so important. It needs to be a space where everyone feels safe. Again, if you look at the structure of the internet, if you had a town planner who went in there, you'd never build a structure of mass global communication like that. If you look at the main places where the conversation's happening, it's places like Facebook, where everyone's siloed off in their own sort of little groups. That's basically like private members clubs. So people aren't meeting, people aren't hearing and talking to each other and sharing different informations and hearing opposing views and getting used to that. Or it's Twitter, which is like some kind of crazy saloon bar in which half the people in there get shot every night. Like this is not, there's no public space where people, you know, minorities, and it's nuts, you know, that you still have to say minorities when you talk about women and people of color and the LGBTQ community and people who aren't Christian, because that's the majority of the world. But it's nuts that the minority, there's no public space where you would feel happy and safe to be able to talk about this stuff, where you wouldn't every day log on and go, okay, well, I'll expect at least two or three rape or death threats. That's what it takes to talk to the world. This is completely crazy. So we need, first of all, the space. We need to get more of the most important things. We need more female coders, clearly. 92% of coders are male. That is, and this is the language of the future, tech. The fact that only 8% of coders are women is as if we knew in 10 years' time the entire world was going to be speaking Chinese and no women were learning it. You know, that's we are not inventing the future if we do not code. So that's key. So the spaces we do it in, the tone that we do this, so that we make sure that the ideas that we plant here, that we're getting the best possible people together in the best possible place to have these conversations, and that's when we start talking about the new parties and what we would like to see. And so I have, the reason that I've written the book is to kind of go, I've written my manifesto. Some of these suggestions are silly. Because I can't help myself. That's how God made me. And some of them are really serious. I think really key ones are things like companies that pay their tax. There should be a massive difference between the companies that do pay their full whack of tax and the companies that don't. You should be given some kind of kite mark, some kind of, you know, fantastic fucking scroll on your shop. It should say that you are a taxpayer. You know, you should even have a printout underneath about the amount of tax that your company paid that year and how many hospital beds or roads or schools that translates into. You know, we should be getting, why do we not get the receipt for tax? You know, we're consumers, but we don't see what we get for our tax dollars. And we do not see what companies who are not paying their tax are depriving the economy of. Really simple factual things. You need to be able to see these things as a consumer and as a voter. So then the other thing is to convince everybody that they should write their own manifestos. I think that's really key. My belief is that everyone has one idea, however tiny, that would change the world a tiny little bit. And the only way the world ever did change is because someone had a world that just changed it a little bit. And that's what we do. That is essentially what a society should be. And that's not working like that at the moment. Oh, shit, it's 1:45 already. Wow. Well, I mean, there's a bar downstairs. So shall we can do like a couple of questions and then we can all just go off into the night and feel a bit better about our lives? I've got one more piece that I want to read out to the younger people in the audience because I want to give you some advice, but I can do a couple of questions and then I can end on my both funny and heartrending advice to teenage girls. Has anyone got a question? Bear in mind that no one ever wants to ask. Oh, you do? Cool. I was going to say, people are usually shy about asking questions and I sing until they do. So you've just deprived this entire room of my Wuthering Heights by Kate Bush. So well done you. It's piercing. It would set off the alarms over the road.
Reading what you've written has fixed me from ever worrying about, you know, not being confident, so why wait?
Good.
I'm really curious about how you got to be you, and I want to know what role parenthood played in your worldview and perspective.
Oh, what, my parents' parenthood or me being a parent? Oh, right, okay. But me being a parent has just simply left me very exhausted. I'd like to say I've learned a lot from it and become very noble and rah, 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 and then I grew and I went on a journey. No, I'm just very tired. This bullshit that women can only become kind of wise and noble and fantastic when they've had kids, it's the biggest con we've ever been sold as a society. You could learn everything I've learned from parenthood by climbing a mountain, drinking some whiskey, learning some poetry that you can recite by heart, having two best friends that you don't treat like shit. You know, just by being a human being. So yes, I've learned nothing from parenthood. Don't fall for the hype, ladies. Go and have fun. Seriously, there's enough kids out there. Oh, my ovaries are wearing out and I won't have a baby. Good. I'm glad for you. I hope they wear it quickly. You'll have swerved a bullet. Rejoice. Run towards the menopause. How did I be who I am? I was thinking about this recently, and I think one of the key things was, because I was home educated, I never read any books by kind of classic white male authors. I was looking at what my kids are being asked to read at school now, and the curriculum's changed for the better in terms of representation over the last 20 or 30 years. But you know, if I had read Philip Roth or Raymond Chandler or Faulkner or even the James Bond books, I would have a really terrible view of myself as a woman, because when you read the descriptions of women through those male gazes, it's horrible. You know, you know, if I'd been reading that, I'd be going, God, do I walk in the room in a sexy way? Do I make a bishop want to kick in a stained glass window? Like, kind of, you know, it's a beautiful line, but it's an awful thing for a girl to have in her head. Like, kind of, you know, I'm quite a gawky person. The idea that every time I walk in a room, I should be making a bishop want to kick in a stained glass window. That's a big burden. Like, kind of, I'm happy to just walk in a room, you know? I don't want to change someone's fucking life. Like, I'm just literally moving. So I just had completely instinctively only read 19th century female literature, which would just really seem to chime with my life, you know, Anne of Green Gables and What Katie Did and Jane Eyre. I just saw sort of weird working class girls who just kept on keeping on. And that sort of, they seem to be really good role models for me. And they always make a point in all those books. And Jane Austen, they always go, and this girl was not beautiful at all. And I love that. There's such a difference. Men don't even realize they're doing it when they're writing a female character and they were like, and like, she was just astonishingly fucking hot, man. Or they'll try and throw you a bone and go, she had a slightly odd nose, but she was still astonishingly fucking hot, man. Whereas female authors will immediately page one and be like, no, this girl had a terrible ass. She had a face like a bucket with a dent in it, but I love her. And that did me good. Has anyone else got a question? Or shall I do my inspiring, stirring reading? Oh, you've got a question. Sorry, darling.
Hi. Hey, hello. Thanks for the talk. So in the last 3 weeks, there's been a lot of talk that I've been involved with about what we should hope for out of Trump in the presidency. On the one hand, some people say, we want this guy to be a disaster. We want to make it extremely clear how terrible he is so that we get him out as quickly as possible in just 4 years. On the other hand, there is, you know, think about how really, really badly the impact will be, how many people are going to be hurt if this guy is in fact as bad as we fear. So what's your take? What should we hope for when, sad to say, the time comes next month for this guy to become our commander-in-chief?
Oh, it's going to be hard, isn't it? Like, what are you guys planning to do on the day of the inauguration? Because, like, for Obama's first one... Yeah, you are going. Yeah. I'm not surprised. Like, when the first Obama inauguration, we were watching it on the TV at like 5 a.m. in our house, like crying our eyes out. There's all these blurry pictures of me with a bottle of champagne rubbing it against his face on the TV, just kind of like, drinking with you, dude. I was up all night. My kids came down in the morning for school and they just saw Mum and her uncle and their uncles and aunts just lying on the floor crying, going, this is a great day in democracy. And they're like, Mum, just give me a pat lunch. This is not a great day for me. Are people going to leave town? Who's going to put hands up if you're going to leave town?
Women's March.
Oh, right. Is that what's happening? Oh, nice one. Okay, cool. Women's March. I like that. I mean, one of the things is that it does just mean now. One of the things that I really worry about is that the left is generally spending all its time now trying to guess what's going to happen in the next 4 or 8 years. And, like, obviously, we're still in shock at the moment. This is post-traumatic stress disorder. We're all holding each other's hands. In fact, I would encourage everybody to just put their hand on the knee of the person next to them and just whisper softly and tenderly, it's going to be all right. Could everyone just do that? I think we might need a little moment of healing. Just touch. This is good. I see this healing here. Yeah. That's good. Look, see? And everyone's smiling now. It is going to be all right. Denial. That's good. On the one hand, it is really entertaining to try and sort of like, you know, stroke, you know, you want to prepare yourself to try and work out what's going to happen. But I don't think we can spend any of our energy on that. We need to work on what we're doing now. It's really notable that over the last 20 years, the right came up with so many think tanks and advisory organisations, a sort of grassroots sort of connection of all these different ideas that are fed into it now. The left aren't really doing that. And that's what we need to be doing. So, I mean, the best case scenario is he fucks it up so badly it splits the Republican Party, kind of like, you know, all the mentals fall into the sea and your country becomes halfway decent again. Sorry, darling. Okay. Have you got a plan? Were you doing one of those things where you ask a question but you've actually got the answer? Please say yes.
I'm seriously confused. I don't have a good answer to the question I just asked because who knows? I mean, I hope that he is terrible and that his ideas fail, but not too many people are harmed in the process.
Yes.
I know it's the best of both worlds, but
no.
What else can I do? We've been thrown a very hard curveball.
Oh, can I help you in your confusion by hugging you? Because you sound like Rocky as well, and for like. Such an exotic accent. All right, so another question. Hi. Oh, God, amazing dress. Well done.
Thank you very much. Yeah. First, I want to say I loved How to Be a Woman by so much. I bought like 5 copies. I gave it to everyone
that
I knew.
That paid for these shoes. Thank you.
I gave it to my dad, and it made our relationship like marginally better.
Oh,
so
high five.
It's been a great book. One thing you didn't talk about tonight in particular is the role of women in this election.
Yes.
It's revealed a lot of the ways in which men seem to really hate women or distrust women or just,
yeah.
You know, I think a lot of the view of Hillary came from the fact that she's a woman. And how do we as women sort of react to this and move forward in how much this has revealed that, you know, sexism is still so prevalent?
Yeah, well, someone asked the question last night. I mean, I've got a million things that where everybody really does need to go to the bar. I mean, there's a million things that I think one of the questions I was going to ask myself was, have we learned or gained anything from Hillary's run on the presidency? And yeah, I think a lot of things. First of all, I mean, for me, the main one is realizing that there can be a third act to a woman's life. I didn't realize that I had subconsciously always presumed that around about the time that I had the menopause, that would be the end of my life because I was no longer fertile and I would just simply go hag. And I would live in a cave and I'd brew some herbs and I'd grow my hair both on my head and on my chin and that would be the end of my life. And then when Hillary announced her run of the presidency, it was like, shit, there can be a third act in women's lives. It had just never occurred to me. You know, you have all this, you know, when you first put your feminist goggles on, it takes you to go, oh, it burns. Oh, my God, too much truth. And you sort of spend your entire life kind of like going, oh, my God, I've still got some terrible patriarchal shit buried inside me. So we gained that from Hillary. Like, she will have inspired the next generation. That was amazing. One of the questions someone was asked last night was, what does it say to women in this country and across the world that someone who has boasted about sexual assault has now become the president? And I think the problem there, and I've written this, several comments that I've written here, it's the word sexual. And, you know, I would argue that when I personally would abolish the word rape, and I don't say that in a contentious way, I argue it logically, because when you put the sexual in sexual assault and when you have a special word, rape, which talks about physical injury, then people immediately are able to categorize it as something else. The amount of time, as soon as you say it's a sexual assault, you can see some people going, oh, well, that could have been a bit doubtful. Maybe something was happening there. What's she like? What's her history? It becomes really complicated. Whereas if you just focus on the fact that, you know, like rape is putting a weapon inside someone. You know, you're putting something inside someone and damaging them against their will. Don't put the word sex in it. Don't give it a different name. It's exactly the same as if someone had put a hammer inside you. You know, take the word sex out of it. Don't give it a separate name. It's physical assault. Prosecute it on that basis. And then you take away the whole stigma of kind of being a rape victim. You know, kind of, you know, the sort of the stigma about this whole thing. It's just so much easier if you just go, no, I was, you know, a horrific assault, physical assault happened to me. Stop having the special words for it. I don't think it does women any good. So that would be my main piece of advice there. Yes. Thank you. Could you one more short and tiny question, and then I think, yes.
How do you explain the fact that apparently about 53% of white women in this country voted for a man who admitted to sexual assault and suggested that women who have an abortion should face criminal charges?
Yeah, this is, I mean, I have read, all me and all my left-wing friends have done for the last, you know, however many weeks it's been, it feels like a year already, is just read all the think pieces trying to explain what happened in the same way that we did when Brexit happened. Like, kind of, we're so staggered you've done this. You know, we did Brexit and all we've done for 6 months is sit around going, but this isn't going to work. Like, kind of, you know, it was this weird rebellious kind of act of just, you know, just voting in these people who do not know what they're going to do. They look terrified. The people, the architects of Brexit, the day after they won that vote, which they were not expecting, they looked terrified. And I saw that exact same look on Donald Trump's face in that picture, in that meeting with Barack Obama, where it was just kind of like, Barack's obviously just given a very short list of the kind of things you've got to do. And he's like, fucking Jesus Christ. It just literally hadn't thought it through. And the one thing, and I've read so many incredible pieces and I've retweeted them all and kind of we've all talked about it, but the one thing I haven't seen explained was that vote. I don't understand. You have to presume that there is some, I don't know, I did just presume in the end that it is down to racism and fear. Mm-hmm. I can't see any other reason why it is. I just think women have so little self-esteem. And clearly the balance is that kind of women, a combination of women not liking themselves that much and secretly being a bit racist has allowed this to happen. And that's a sad old fucking thing to have to acknowledge, man. So, yeah. But if anybody's got any brighter, happier ideas, I'd really like to know them. But that is the sad...
Well, the permeation of the culture that we swim in this culture, right?
Yes.
Like my aunt said, he's a ladies' man.
Yeah, yeah.
Right? Well, so self-loathing. But.
Well, that whole thing about it being locker room talk, it's like, you know, kind of like in any... I was talking to my husband about this and he was like, okay, the only conversations I ever hear in the locker rooms that I'm in is, oh my God, my token's not working in this door. Did you take my towel? And does anyone have any fungal foot powder? He was like, my biggest advice to Donald Trump is change gyms. You're in like the Nazi rape gym. That's a bad, just go somewhere nicer. That's what I would say. I'm going to finish with some hope and some advice. It's aimed at younger people, but to be honest, it applies to everybody. It's ostensibly my advice to teenage girls, but I think it's advice to the whole world, really. Except, oh no, there we go. All in a similar life. Here we go. Nearly everything that I've talked about today, there are huge essays on in here. So I would, obviously, I have a vested interest. I've travelled a long way. recommend that you buy the book. 10 things every teenage girl should know. 1, self-loathing is the default mode of teenage girls. You are not alone in this. Contrary to what you think, it's nothing to do with how fat your legs are or the unmanageability of your hair. You are self-loathing because you are turning into a woman, and this will seem to a 13-year-old girl like something exhausting and joyless and high maintenance for which you will be constantly judged. And you're right. By and large, that is exactly what it's like to be a woman now. 2, but you don't need to be like those women. You can choose what kind of woman you want to be. This is the greatest secret in the world. And if those kind of women don't exist, you can reply, those kind of women don't exist. Yet. Yet is going to be a very useful word for you. The world isn't like that. Yet. People don't do things like that. Yet. As a teenage girl, as the future, you are the yet. You are the one who gets to invent the future. You are the one who gets to invent new women, the kind of woman that you would be excited to be. Refer to this process as the revolution, for short, because it sounds more exciting, and you want and deserve the future to be exciting. 3, start the revolution with you. If you are self-loathing, invent a you that you do not loathe instead. Imagine what you want to be, and then be it. Make yourself your project or pet or best friend. Pretend to be confident and happy and relaxed, and you will soon realize there is no difference between pretending and actually being. wear a silver cape, be obsessed with geology, decide to form the world's first girl Beatles, and learn what every drag queen knew before you, that you fake it till you make it. 4, your key hobbies need to be long country walks to get some fresh air into your lungs, masturbation, and the revolution. Between those 3, you should, in the long term, stay relatively sane. 5, don't cut your own fringe. It is far, far more difficult than you would ever imagine. 6, for that matter, don't cut anyone else's either, because good friendships have ended that way. 7, every time your heart gets broken, breathe deep, because here's a secret, it grows bigger when it mends. Imagine each line of red scar tissue on it with pride, the same pride you will have one day for stretch marks on your belly if you have a baby. Skin and hearts tear to make great things, so do not be afraid. And if your mind tears, don't fear that either. Depression takes a layer of skin off. So accept that you feel more of the world than other people. Because did you hear what I just said? You feel more of the world than most people. And that is amazing. And anxiety, that is amazing too. Because it will work like electricity in your bones. It will keep you wakeful and driven so you can use those extra hours and those extra sleepless days that your adrenaline-poisoned body is giving you to live longer. You live in double time. Insist that it is a blessing. You will fake that until you make that too. 9. When in doubt, listen to David Bowie. In 1968, David Bowie was a gay, ginger, bonk-eyed, snaggletooth freak walking around South London in a dress and being bullied by thugs. 4 years later, he was exactly the same thing, but everyone else wanted to be like him too. If David Bowie could make being David Bowie cool, then you can make you cool. Plus, unlike David Bowie, you get to listen to David Bowie for inspiration. So you're one up on David Bowie. You're already ahead of David Bowie. 10, go out there and change the world so it works for you and every girl like you. I know you will. Here are 10 things that teenage boys need to know. 1, everything in the previous list. It is exactly the same for you. Thank you for coming. Let's all stay lovely. Yes, this is the fuckpocalypse, but we can stay calm and strong together. The future will be amazing. It always is. Thank you for coming. I'm doing a signing. Thank you very much.
Please, you guys can all get through something.
Live at Politics and Prose is a co-production of The Bookstore and Slate.com. For information about upcoming Politics and Prose events, visit politics-prose.com. And please let us know what you think of this program. Our email is podcasts@slate.com.